Okay, we're going to revisit evolution and creation today, although we'll be spending most of our time discussing evolution and the strengths of the argument for evolution and the weaknesses, and there are both. A brief review from last week. Evolution requires genetic change in order for it to occur, and that change occurs in three ways. Through natural selection, which is the effects of the environment upon the genetic makeup of individuals that would tend to give one individual an advantage over another. The natural selection is without question functioning. We gave the example of the moths in England that originally were white, with a very few dark moths sprinkled into the population. And then during the Industrial Revolution, when the tree trunks became covered with soot from the coal fires, the birds were able to see the white moths easier against the darkened trunks, and so they ate more white moths, and all of a sudden the population switched over and they became more dark moths. This is not macroevolution. This is microevolution. That was the environment change selecting for a trait that was already existent within the population. But it is a very powerful tool for allowing us to understand how the environment exerts an effect upon populations of individuals. Okay. So natural selection through the environmental changes, and then what is called genetic drift. Genetic drift occurs in three ways. That is, it occurs by inbreeding. That would be closely related individuals breeding with one another, which would tend to concentrate genes. And then hybridization, which is less closely related individuals, but who are capable of breeding with one another, which would be mule deer and white-tailed deer, where their ranges overlap. You get a hybrid individual, but it's getting an exchange of DNA from the mule deer and from the white-tailed deer. And then mutation itself, which is a spontaneous, permanent change in the genetic makeup of an individual. Without there being these three things working, there can be no evolution. In other words, if the environment was totally static, that there was no inbreeding, no hybridization, and no mutation, there would be no kind of change within individuals. Okay. Evolution, classical evolution, requires immense periods of time and pure random chance. That is, it requires really long time periods for very tiny little changes to be accumulated until an individual actually has a competitive advantage that would be selected by natural selection. And the last common ancestor, this is according to evolutionists, of all living organisms upon the face of the earth, whether it be plant or animal, was a single cell that spontaneously occurred 3.5 to 4 billion years ago. From that point onward, all life descended by change. And so Darwin's original definition of evolution was descent with modification. The current definition of evolution is change over time. Okay. Now, although there are many examples of microevolution, that is, the finches on the Galapagos Islands changing the length of their beak because they were able to compete for seeds that were more difficult to get than the finches with short beaks, for instance, that occurs because the environment is selecting for a population with longer beaks so that they could feed on the seeds that are more difficult to get to. But they're still finches. There never has been an example of macroevolution, which is the change of one genus to another. In other words, cats have never become dogs. Dogs have never become cats. And it is incorrect to say that evolutionists say that man descended from apes. They do not say that. What they say is that at some point in time in the distant past, there was a common ancestor between apes and men, and then there was a divergence of the genes of those individuals, and that eventually led to men and to the great apes. But we did not descend from chimpanzees. Okay, we have to understand that. And to make that argument shows ignorance on our part, so we should never do that. We did not descend. We had a common ancestor at some point in time. Of course, there's no way to know that individual. So what the holy grail of evolution is a transitional form. That is an individual that would show traits of two different genuses. So in other words, evolutionists currently believe that birds descended from dinosaurs. And so their holy grail would be a fossil that would have both obvious dinosaur characteristics and obvious bird characteristics. For many, many years, since the 1800s actually, there's been a fossil known as Archaeopteryx, which means ancient bird, which has been held up to be a fusion between dinosaurs and birds by evolutionists. Recently, ornithologists who know about birds have studied that fossil and have determined that Archaeopteryx is nothing more or less than an extinct bird. It never was, never could have been a dinosaur because of certain characteristics that made it a true bird. And as the ornithologist said, bird flight did not occur from the ground to the tree, it occurred from the tree to the ground. Okay. And so the birds have to be able to perch in the tree. Dinosaurs would not be able to run on the ground with perching feet. And that Archaeopteryx had perching feet, so that makes it a true bird. Besides which, feathers are an extremely complex structure. If you look at an actual drawing of a feather complex, it is an extremely complex structure. You would not have expected fully formed feathers to be present in a transitional form because it wouldn't have had time for those feathers to develop because it still was part dinosaur and part bird. Okay. Any questions from what we talked about last week or what we've just gone over? That isn't clear. Okay. Because of the extreme lack of transitional forms in the fossil record, paleontologists particularly are easily duped by fraud. And the reason is because there are no transitional forms that can be stated categorically, this is part dinosaur and part bird. And we talked about the little guy in Mongolia that knew the paleontologists were looking for such a fossil. And so he said, no problem. He found a fossil bird, he found a fossil dinosaur, cut the fossils in half, put them together, and this was heralded as proof that that birds descended from dinosaurs. It was only later proved to be a fraud. Faster.
What if somebody brings up the pterodactyl, a flying dinosaur? Did you read anything about
it? It's a flying dinosaur.
It's still a dinosaur.
It's still a dinosaur. It's not a bird. No, that would be a flying dinosaur, just like there are gliding squirrels, flying squirrels. They're still squirrels. The only difference is they have a modification that allows them to leap off a height and glide. And pterodactyls had to do the same thing. They were more like gliders, so they had to rely on thermals and all that kind of stuff. And if they were able, and I believe if the feeling is if they were able ever on the ground, without being able to launch themselves, they wouldn't have been able to fly at all. Okay. Currently, classical Darwinism has lost a lot of its support. There are still classical Darwinists that believe everything can be explained by chance mutation over long periods of time. There are now neo-Darwinists. Neo-Darwinists have synthesized natural selection with Mendelian genetics. Remember, we referred to Mendel and the inheritance of simple traits. And in your handout, if you look at it on your, I believe it's the third page of the handout, there is a simple Mendelian square. In this example, we've got two individuals who are what we would call heterozygous for the color white. These are pea plants. Capital B would be a dominant trait. Little b would be a recessive trait. And the dominant trait always holds sway over the recessive when it occurs together. And so if you have two white pea plants that have one dominant gene for white and one recessive gene for pink, the plants will have white blossoms. However, if you breed those plants, this is what this square shows you. The first square says capital B, capital B, that is a white pea plant, and it will always produce white pea plants. To the right is a capital B, little b, that is also a white pea plant. It looks white, but it carries a gene for pink. You get two of those in this simple breeding, and you get one which is recessive for both of the genes, and that would be a pink pea plant, even though both of the parents were white pea plants. And that's how simple traits are transmitted, okay? Now, most genetic traits are not that simple. Pea plants in peas are that simple. And Mendel was able to elucidate that through very careful breeding experiments. And now evolutionists have taken Mendelian genetics, and we know a whole lot more about genetics now, and they are using that to prove evolution, and that's got quotes around it. The fossil record shows species occur spontaneously in the fossil record. They exist for extremely long periods of time, and then they disappear. That is what is in the fossil record. There is no question about that. Okay. So a man named Stephen Gould, a proponent of evolution, has theorized a new theory, which is called punctate equilibria, which says, yes, that's true. Species occur suddenly in the fossil record. They exist unchanged for extremely long time periods, and then they disappear. So the only way evolution can work is if there are sudden bursts of evolutionary change, which he called punctate equilibria. Now, that's an important concept. I want you to keep that in the back of your mind. If we apply, so now Gould can't tell us what factors would be responsible for sudden massive genetic change within a population. He just says it must have occurred because we've got all this diversity of life that arose from a single cell. So consequently, because the fossil record tells us that species occur suddenly, they exist for a long period of time unchanged and then disappear, that means that when there's genetic change, it has to occur very, very rapidly on a geological time frame. And the biggest problem that they run into is what is called the Cambrian explosion. All right, the Cambrian period occurred 540 million years ago. Dating, of course, is suspect, okay, but 540 million years ago, and within a 10 million year time span, all of the major animal types soft animal types of ocean dwelling creatures occurred. Okay? And evolution says there's no way that could happen, because 10 million years, when you're working on 540 million years, is nothing more than the blink of an eye from the standpoint of time. Okay? And so there's just no way. So Gould says, oh, okay, well, something happened during the Cambrian Age that suddenly created all this massive genetic change within the oceans, and then those species occurred. They existed unchanged for long periods of time, and then they disappeared. Okay? And that would be called punctate equilibrium. So what he is, so Dr. Gould is appealing to the fact that evolution occurs. Okay, that's his given. And so in order to accommodate that, he believes that there are certain times when massive amounts of genetic change occurs in a very short time period, and then we take over another period of stasis where there's very little change within those populations until another something occurs. And they cannot tell us what the something is, except that it's probably more than one something. It's probably multiple somethings, but we have no idea what those multiple somethings are. But they had to have occurred because evolution is true. Lee.
You open the comments?
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't that a classic example of circular reasoning or circular logic? I assume that evolution is true. Therefore, this 10 million period of year, as unlikely as it is, must have occurred in the 540. And having the 10 million years of this massive explosion proves evolution.
Right. And remember what we said last week. PhDs know a whole lot about very little. So, paleontologists know nothing about zoology. Zoologists know nothing about paleontology. Okay. Zoologists don't know anything about ornithology because that's a subgroup within zoology. Okay. So a PhD in any of these disciplines knows a whole lot about birds. He knows nothing about mammals other than what he learned in high school biology. Okay. So the paleontologist assumes that the geologist has proved that the fossil record is correct. The geologist assumes that the paleontologist has proven that the fossil record is correct. But neither one of them know the other discipline. There is too much information, too much knowledge to be had for any one individual to be truly a Renaissance man. You cannot know geology, paleontology, zoology, embryology, ornithology, mammalology, or any of the other ologies in their extent because there's too much information. So the more specialized a person becomes, the more they know about very little. And you need to keep that in mind because these individuals make grandiose claims on very little supportive information. In philosophy, there is a statement called Occam's Razor. That's spelled O-C-K-H-A-M. William of Occam was a mathematician, philosopher, theologian in the 1200s. And he came up with what he called his razor, which was when there are two competing theories, the theory that has the fewest assumptions is more likely to be correct. And so this is a way for philosophers to pare away unnecessary appeals to interventions. In other words, if Tom Diffel and Stephen Gould were met in the forest and they were talking about evolution versus, in this case, intelligent design, and they were having a decent discussion, no animosity, no heat, each one deciding, trying to describe their position. And they came to a split in the road, and in the road there were two trees that were knocked down, fallen across. Dr. Gould had to go to the left, Dr. Diffel had to go to the, not that I'm a PhD, but Dr. Diffel had to go to the right to go home. And they elected to come back tomorrow with an explanation for what happened to these trees, because the day before the trees were standing. Now we know the night before that meeting there was a tremendous windstorm. So Dr. Diffel comes back the next morning and says, you know, that wind we had the night before was sufficient to knock both these trees down. And Dr. Gould says, oh, no. The trees are down. They were hit by two separate meteorites to knock them down. Those meteorites then hit one another and totally disintegrated, leaving no trace. Occam's razor would say, Dr. Diffel is only postulating a single occurrence to account for both trees being knocked down, and Dr. Gould is appealing to at least five things to cause these trees to be knocked down. Okay, so by Occam's razor, we would select my theory. Both of them explain why the trees were knocked down, but my theory is the one more likely to have occurred. So the point is, the more assumptions that have to be made, the less likely, even though all those assumptions are, even though they both come to the same conclusion. Okay, in other words, I can say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, that accounts for creation. Accounts for everything that we know about. The evolutionists could say, in the beginning, there was a tiny bit of matter that exploded all by itself for unknown reasons, with no direction, no planning, and that creates all this, that there is. Okay. In addition to that, the evolutionists will say that we can account for all the changes that we see, both cosmologically and on Earth, by chance over time. Okay, everything we see is chance over time. One of the major problems is that the universe is expanding. Now, I am nowhere near, it's way above my pay grade, even to even come close to being able to understand the mathematics of that. But the universe is expanding. And it's expanding at a rate of 1,055. And I'm not sure what the units are. If it expanded at a rate of 1,060, nothing would form because the matter would be coming apart too quickly. If it expanded at a rate of 1,030, it would have fallen back on itself into its original little dot. So there is a constant of expansion within the universe that is so precise, its very preciseness argues for intelligence. Because there's not a wide enough variation to allow for chance to be involved here. Gravitational constants between all of the structures in the universe are extremely closely related to one another at 1,040. Again, I don't know what the units are. More than that, it wouldn't work. Less than that, it wouldn't work. So the argument from cosmology is that we've got universal constants that are so closely defined that that has to have a superintelligence behind it. Okay. If you will look at your first page of your handout, we'll go back to our mousetrap. Dr. Michael Behe, a biochemist at Lehigh University in the 1990s, proposed a theory of irreducible complexity and intelligent design. So what Dr. Behe said is, any system that has three or more components cannot occur by gradual change. So we look at our mousetrap. There are five components of a mousetrap. There's the platform, a holding bar, a catch, a spring, and a hammer. If any change occurs in any one of those structures, the mousetrap won't work. If the spring is too strong or too weak, it won't flip the hammer over if it's too weak and kill the mouse. If it's too strong, the catch bar and the catch and the holding bar won't be able to hold it against the power of the spring. If the hammer is too long or too short, it won't catch the mouse. Okay? So in order for change to occur in what he called an irreducible complex structure, it requires multiple changes occurring all at the same time. Because remember, evolution says that natural selection selects for an advantage. Where there is no advantage, there is no selection. So you can't accumulate catch bars in your cell for no purpose. So you can't build up a whole bunch of catch bars and then 10 million years later, you start building up some springs that are uniquely able to be worked with that catch bar, which now has to stay stable. And now, but there's no advantage to it because it doesn't do anything. There's no advantage to the spring either, okay, because it doesn't do anything. Until finally you've got all five of these components all together, and then miraculously they have to come together to form a mousetrap. So Dr. Behe argues that when you have irreducible complexity, you cannot have evolutionary change occurring by gradations. It has to be massive change all occurring at the same time in order for it to work. And there's no mechanism that we have that accounts for that. Because the vast majority of mutations are detrimental. They are not beneficial. And we know that for sure. Okay. Darwin looked at the cell. All organs are made up, all tissue is made up of cells. All organs are made up of tissue within that. Okay, blah, 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 all the way along. The cell is the unit, okay? Darwin's microscope of Darwin's day, 1850s, was extremely simple and did not give very good resolution. So Darwin looked at the cell as a black box. Engineers know what black boxes are. Black boxes are something's coming in, something's coming out, but we have no idea what's happening in the middle. That's a black box. Okay. So Darwin considered the cell to be a black box, a simple structure. Now that we know with the more powerful microscopes of today, electron microscopy, that the cell is incredibly complex. And the deeper we look into the cell, the more complex it becomes. A cell is really best thought of as a huge metropolitan area with perfectly designed roadways, perfectly built buildings, perfect airports, so that raw materials arrive at the right time in the right quantities. They are processed at the right time in the right quantities. They are distributed to warehouses in the right places at the right times so that they can be used as necessary at the right time in the right place. Perfectly designed. No bottlenecks. Nothing comes in the way of the transport of raw materials into the cell and the final excretion of waste products, except if there's a genetic mutation. My grandson has a genetic mutation. It is called mucolipidosis 3. His cells are unable to excrete waste products. So those waste products build up in his cells over time, and they die. The cells die. If enough cells die, the tissue dies. If enough tissue dies, the organ dies. If enough organ dies, the system dies. If enough systems die, my grandson dies. And he will die somewhere between 12 and 15 years of age. There is no treatment for this condition. The problem is his cells process everything properly, but he does not excrete properly. And that's a single genetic mutation. Neither his mother nor his father had this disease, but they carried the recessive gene for the disease because they were Asians, and Asians have more of this particular disease than other races. So he has that disease, unfortunately. So, in Darwin's view, the cell is a 2x4 compared to a finished house. Okay. That's his view. But we know that that's not true. The cell is incredibly complex. And as a result of that, the likelihood of a random mutation occurring that would be beneficial is extremely small. Individual cells, now there are a group of animals called protozoa. Protozoa are one-celled animals. They move, they eat, they excrete, and they reproduce. They are the simplest form of animal life on the face of this earth. Nobody can tell you how to build a protozoa, starting with the individual building blocks and combining them together to create a protozoan, whether it be an amoeba, which moves by shooting out little pseudopods and inching forward, or a paramecium, which has little hairs all over its body that row together, and the paramecium can swim through its environment. They're almost all aquatic individuals, protozoa. Okay. You can refer then to your second page, which is the flagellum. A flagellum is a propeller. It's used by bacteria to move through a medium. If you will look at that, the top image is an actual electron micrograph of a flagellum. The bottom image is a line drawing of the flagellum, and that looks like a rotary engine. Right? That's what it looks like. That spins at 1,500 revolutions per second. Not per minute, per second. So we got to multiply that by 10. That's 15,000 revolutions per second, and then 6 on top of that, which makes 90,000 revolutions a minute. There's no motor that we have that's that efficient. They would burn up if they spun that fast. And yet this occurs for the entire lifetime of that bacteria. So Michael Behe argues that when you see obvious evidence of design, you had best consider there's a designer. Because there is no advantage to the bacteria of any of these components, and of which there are over 40 different proteins that make up this bacteria bacterial flagellum. There is no advantage to the bacteria to build those up and store them in the bacteria over time until all 40 of those come together to punch a hole through the bacterial cell wall, which can't kill the bacteria, right? And produce the flagellum, so this spinning converts to this spinning to drive him through a liquid medium. Okay. So Behe argues that where there is obvious evidence of design, you have to postulate a designer. So irreducible complexity is tied to the concept of intelligent design. Now, intelligent design theorists do not postulate a creator. They say simply that there has to be a designer somewhere to produce this kind of material. It cannot have occurred by evolutionary forces because evolution requires little changes over extremely long time periods, and the only way those changes accumulate is if they give an advantage to the organism. It would be inefficient to accumulate all this stuff and not be able to use it for a purpose. The same way my grandson is accumulating all these waste products in his cells, he can't get rid of them. It would be the same situation for a bacteria building up product. Now, could those things be used for something different in the meantime? Yeah, they could. They could. So that was the analogy of the pulley system, right? Got two pulleys, clothesline in between. My wife can load the laundry onto the clothesline from a fixed point as she feeds it through the pulley. But a pulley of that nature is not a block and tackle, although block and tackles are made up of pulleys and ropes. But that multiplies the mechanical advantage of the little guy like me pulling on the one rope to lift the heavy weight. But if any of those blocks, which are a group of pulleys, are not in the system, a block and tackle won't work. Okay? So irreducible complexity says it isn't that those parts couldn't have been used for something else. When they exist as a group, they have to have occurred all at the same time. So irreducible complexity says that if you have that many parts in the system, it isn't that the individual parts, the pulley could be used in the block and tackle as well as on the clothesline, but the block and tackle won't work if you take a pulley away. Okay? It won't work. So it is irreducibly complex from the standpoint of a block and tackle, even though it is made up of pulleys, which you could use for another purpose. Okay? That's an important concept to keep in mind. So that if you are arguing, and this is not designed for you to argue with Stephen Jay Gould, this is designed for you to argue with Aunt Mabel. Okay? That irreducible complexity means that the structure would not function if any one part was changed. Not that the parts couldn't be used for something else. One of the evolutionists did a video, and he took the mouse trap, and of course, mouse traps are held by little staple. You know, the parts are all held by staples. So he ripped the arm off the bar, and then he tore the catch out, and then he opened the hammer, and he put it across his tie, as a tie clasp. And he says, this proves that irreducible complexity isn't true. No, all it proves is that if you pare the mousetrap down, it's no longer a mousetrap, but it might be a tie clasp. That's what it proves. It doesn't disprove irreducible complexity. Because they're arguing apples and oranges. Behe says the mousetrap won't work if you make a change in it. Not that the hammer and the platform couldn't be used for a tie clasp if you chose to. Okay. In 1960, a team of James Watson and Francis Crick astonished the world when they were able to tell us the structure of DNA. Actually, Francis Crick was mulling over all this information that had been accumulated over a decade about DNA. And he said, what shape could it be? They had studied it. They had hashed it out. Teams all over the world were trying to be the first ones to come up with the structure of DNA, which is our genetic material. And he's walking into the cafeteria and got hit with a lightning bolt. And he said to Watson, it's a double helix. And he was right. Okay, it's double helix. And that double helix is DNA, which is deoxyribonucleic acid. Okay, that's what it is. Okay, which is made up of two carbon filaments that wrap around each other this way, two of them together, so that's what a helix is, joined by four base pairs in different combinations. And that's what makes up individual genes within the DNA. James Watson has passed away. Francis Crick, I believe, is still alive. When they elucidated the shape of the DNA, the double helix, Francis Crick said, you know what? Evolution could not have occurred on the Earth to produce this structure. No way that this could happen by natural forces on the Earth, even the primordial Earth, 4 billion years ago. He is a proponent of a theory called panspermia. Panspermia says that microbes arrived on Earth either by hitchhiking on meteorites and crashing into the Earth, and those bacteria then began the process of evolution that led to all that is, or those bacteria arrived on Earth from aliens who were visiting our solar system, and they left behind some detritus that had bacteria in it, and those bacteria began to the evolution change. That's called panspermia. There are very few individuals who believe this theory, but Francis Crick is one of them, because he says the structure of DNA prohibits evolution from ever have occurred on this Earth as we know it. So somehow DNA or RNA, because there are bacteria that have only RNA as opposed to DNA, but there are bacteria with DNA as well, only if they could have come from someplace else fully formed could we have had evolution. He believes in evolution. He just doesn't believe that it occurred spontaneously from natural functions within the primordial Earth. And this is the man who intuitively realized what the structure of DNA was, because no one had figured it out yet until he walked into the cafeteria and was hit by a bolt of intuitive lightning, and he said it's a double helix, and he was 100% correct. Now, the important thing to remember is that there has never been a biochemical pathway described by a biochemist that takes an initial building block and through known biochemical steps arrives at another structure like hemoglobin or the clotting cascade in our bodies. Okay? Extremely complex situations. But they have never been able to say this chemical that we know, this biochemical that we know, as a precursor through this step by this catalyst, change that thing to this, change that thing to that, change that thing to this, and voila, we have hemoglobin. Okay? And that's what would be required in order to show that evolution has a possibility of existing. And there are no biochemists that have ever been able to do that. There have been experiments where they produced amino acids, but the amino acids did not prove that you could produce life from those. Okay. And not only do they have to be able to produce hemoglobin, but they have to figure some way to integrate it into a red blood cell. So if you produce the hemoglobin out here, and you've got your whatever this cell is, it's not a red blood cell because it doesn't have any hemoglobin in it, right? How does this get in here? They have no idea. No idea at all. When we talk about eyes, and there are myriads of eyes on our Earth, there are human eyes, there are animal eyes, there are insect eyes, there are fish eyes, all kinds of eyes. All with vastly different structures, even within mammalian eyes. Ever looked at a goat's eye? The pupil is horizontal. Looks funny because it's not round. Okay. And that's an eye, like we would recognize it for what it is. Okay, so when you ask an evolutionist, well, how did the eyes occur? They always start with a photosensitive cell. That's already an incredibly complex structure. How did that cell become photosensitive? Well, it did because we got eyes. That's the argumentation.
Question.
Yes?
At the risk of derailing your momentum, an Aunt Mabel question. Didn't they, by cloning, produce a living organism a little while ago? Like a pony or...
Well, yeah, but they took an ovum and they extracted the nucleus and they implanted a fertilized nucleus into that.
So if I had a question, it would be, did by doing this cloning and the result being a living organism, did scientists create life?
No.
Tell
no.
Me why.
Because they couldn't produce the ova to begin with.
So it came out of an ova, a living ova.
It right. Yeah, they put material into an ovum, a female egg. Okay, that's what they did. All that shows is that a really intelligent designer can do something. That's what that proves.
Isn't that tantamount to artificial insemination?
Well, on a extremely microscopic level, sure. Because in artificial insemination, you're having the ovum and the sperm from different individuals put together in a petri dish. Okay, but that's still they're still functioning normally. That is, the sperm has to penetrate the egg. But in cloning experiments, they're manipulating the genetic material and taking it from one individual and putting it into another cell, an ovum, where without destroying the ovum. So the science behind that is extremely complex, but all it proves is that a well-trained and skillful designer can manipulate stuff.
It's genetic engineering.
Yeah, we can manipulate things, but it is not an argument for evolution at all. It's just it's more of an argument for intelligent design. Okay, and remember that all experiments are going to be, to one degree or another, clouded by the bias of the experimenter. And the applications and the judgments based on the experiment will also be affected by the bias of the experimenter. So in medicine, if they are going to give a drug to people, the highest level of information that can be derived from those tests is what's called a double-blinded study. And in a double-blinded study, you have two populations of individuals, okay, as balanced as they possibly can be made through interviewing those individuals. You have a drug, and you have a placebo. That is, you have a nothing. It doesn't do anything. And the doctors who are prescribing those drugs don't know whether they're prescribing the drug or placebo. Because that takes out of that the bias of the individual, particularly of the person receiving the drug. Because if I am absolutely convinced that drug A is going to make me feel better, I probably will be better, feel better if I take drug A. Okay? And that is the bias of me. And if the doctor is convinced that drug A is going to help me, and he knows he's giving me drug A, he is going to communicate to me that this is the real stuff, man. You can expect really help from this. Okay. So a double-blinded study is the only way to remove all that bias from the situation. And there have never been any double-blinded studies from the standpoint of evolution. In other words, and the reason they're not. What's the primary reason why we always have to say evolution is a theory? It's not fact. You've never proven it. And you can't prove it. Because there's no experimenter that can go back in time 4 billion years ago and start the experiment. And if he could, he wouldn't live long enough to see how the experiment turned out. So it isn't that evolutionists can't say, we can explain certain things by evolution. We can explain microevolution very effectively by natural selection. No question about that. It's true. It occurs. But that is not the same as macroevolution. And the problem is they take facts of microevolution and make this massive leap into whatever to prove that evolution occurred on this earth. And why is that? What is the driving force for that? Because if you accept irreducible complexity and intelligent design, and Michael Behe does not say that designer is a creator, he just says, well, you see obvious design, there has to be a designer. That's what he says. But the evolutionist knows that right behind that intelligent designer is a creator God. And the God that we serve, or should serve, is the God that spoke the universe into existence. And the Latin for that is creatio ex nihilo, which means creation from nothing. There is no part of our God in our creation. He did not take a little piece of his arm and throw it out there into whatever it was and speak the world, the universe into existence. Otherwise, we might be justified in worshiping the universe. But because our God created it from nothing, we worship the creator, not the created individual. And that's why Romans 1, 19 through 32, particularly Romans 22, I think, through 27, is an extremely important scripture, because it talks about, and the they that's in that is Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve, thinking themselves to be wise, became fools and began to worship the created things instead of the creator, even though they knew God. They knew God. They walked with him. They talked with him. But because they saw that the tree was good to look at and had nice-looking fruit that was good for food and was to be desired for making one wise, they chose to throw over their relationship with God, because thinking themselves to be wise, they became fools. Any questions? We got about 5 minutes. And I thoroughly confused everyone. Okay.
This is very complex, but I think you've made it understandable.
Well, understandable from the standpoint that understand that the vast majority of people who believe in evolution believe in evolution. They've never reflected upon it. They've never studied it. Those people that believe Islam is the religion of peace have never studied Islam. They are just going by what they're being told. And the same thing happens to people that go through high school science. They're shown Ernst Haeckel's drawings. Oh, what's our phrase that ends every argument with victory on your part? Ontology recapitulates phylogeny. That's all you got to say. And then walk away when you have totally devastated your debate opponent, because nobody knows what that means. But what it does mean is the changes that an individual goes through from conception to birth recapitulates the evolutionary changes of the species that became that individual. And that was a man named Ernst Haeckel. Has been disproven since 1900. Ernst Haeckel's drawings were in my high school biology book in the 1960s. So even though it had been a disproven theory and no serious scientist ever was believing in it, it was still being taught in high school science. And for those individuals that have not gone on to study anything else, they still believe that Ernst Haeckel showed that all these little embryos from the fish to this ended up as people, which it didn't. He falsified his drawings. Because he was a committed evolutionist, because he was a committed atheist. Okay, we're done.